Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and today we're talking about film history. We'll be joined later in the show by our good friend Elliot Levine. He'll be hosting some events featuring films from the new Hollywood era of the 1970s. Right now, though, we're joined by the founder and president of the Film Noir Foundation. He is a film preservationist, a festival programmer, a San Francisco Literary Laureate, and the host of Noir Alley on the Turner Classic Movies channel. And he's coming to Portland for the upcoming Noir City Film Festival. Eddie Muller, welcome to Words and Pictures.
It is a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me. And congratulations. You just told me before we came on that you've been doing this for 20 years, and I've been doing my festivals for 25 years now, so congratulations on the durability.
The stick-to-itiveness, that's right. Well, Eddie, let's start with a little bit of background. Our audience is pretty shrewd, but not everybody is steeped in film history. Give us a few of the basics about the film noir genre.
It's funny. Right off the bat, we can get into a discussion of, is it in fact a genre or not? Because this is something that people talk about all the time. So I call it, I mean, most of the films are in what you would call the crime genre, but that doesn't quite get to the gist of it. It was an artistic movement. And for our purposes, we'll talk about this in terms of American films and Hollywood, although we've learned that as the upcoming festival will show, that it crossed borders, obviously. And so not all the movies were from America in mid-20th century, but there was an artistic movement in which this style of filmmaking became very prevalent without there being necessarily an economic reason for that. And, you know, in American movies, nothing begets success, like, you know, copying something. But it was just interesting that this was driven by the artists. The writers wanted to write things in a certain way, and the directors were very drawn to this visual style, and the cameramen started shooting things a different way. And then the actors got into it saying, yeah, I'd like to kind of sully up my good guy image by playing somebody who is a compromised protagonist. And that's where you ended up seeing, you know, people like Fred McMurray and Tyrone Power playing bad guys in movies instead of their usual, in Power's case, swashbuckling hero or lightweight leading man. So it was a very interesting artistic movement. All kinds of reasons for it that we can talk about, but that was basically it. And they're crime films.
Well, you can talk about noir films that go back to the 30s or even further back, but in the post-war era, the 1940s and 50s, that was kind of the high point. And studios were still not generally giving these noir films the big budgets. You know, the so-called A movies were musicals, historical epics, family comedies, dramas. The noirs were often lumped in with the B movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And they didn't need a lot of money to make these films, which is one of the reasons why it became a movement. Because remember, this is coming out of World War II. I mean, the movement started during World War II, even preceded it a little bit. But during the war, there were economic constraints on how much money could be spent on a film set. You know, $5,000 was the maximum that a studio was allowed to spend on a movie set during the war. And so crime pictures, by their very nature, are kind of low budget. The action is taking place in the margins. Right. You don't have big sweeping vistas. There's no frontier to explore. There's, you know, no hordes of Roman centurions or anything. It's just, you know, people in hotels and corner bars and stuff like that. So the movies were inexpensive to make, but the writers loved doing it because, you know, even to this day, let's face it, a lot of directors starting out make something that could be called a film noir. Because it's not a big budget thing. You know, when you look at the Coen brothers making Blood Simple as their first film, that's obviously a riff on film noir, and it didn't cost them a lot of money. And the same thing always applied. So, I mean, even if you call it film noir or neo-noir or whatever, these are stories about peoples who they live lives of desperation in the margin of society. Ergo, you don't need a huge budget to convey that.
And we think of the big players in film noir films as being like grizzled men. But one of the things that film noir offered was great complex roles for women.
Absolutely. Next year, Running Press is coming out with an updated and revised edition of my book, Dark City Dames, which specifically just looked at actresses who were sort of synonymous with film noir. And yeah, the roles are fantastic. And I know what you're saying, that people assume it's a very male-dominated genre, because most films were back then, you know, especially if they were crime films. But that's what made film noir to me so interesting, is that there were women who were allowed to be the protagonists of these movies who had their own desperate situations, right? And so you get, you know, the battle between Barbara Stanwyck and Joan Crawford, like who's the queen of film noir, right? And you know, you can throw other actresses into that mix as well. Some of their most famous roles, Rita Hayworth in The Lady from Shanghai, or Ava Gardner in The Killers. Ida Lupino, of course, made a big impact in noir films. Yeah, and people always say, does it have to have a femme fatale to be a film noir? And I say, no, it doesn't have to, but those are the best ones.
Well, we mentioned that you're coming to Portland and you're going to be showing off some real classics here. I think the one that might be really familiar to a lot of people is In a Lonely Place, starring Humphrey Bogart. There's The Man Who Cheated Himself. There's Night Has a Thousand Eyes, Never Open That Door, The Window, and Gilda. Tell us a little bit about, this is obviously a selection that you've personally curated.
Yes. And I found that, you know, it's interesting when you start out doing this, or at least when I started out doing this, I was already, you know, I was older when I first started programming films. I was, what am I going to say? I was in my 40s. I was like 40 years old or something. And I had been watching movies for a long time and I wanted to show all the rare stuff because it was so exciting to realize that there were movies that just never got shown anymore on a big screen. But after you do this for a while, you realize, wow, you know, there are a lot of people, it turns over. So, right, when you do something for 25 years, I realize I have people coming to the theater to watch these movies who were not born when I started doing this. And so you do have to keep going back to the well to show the established classics like Gilda, right? There's a whole generation that have not seen that movie. Probably one of the most popular, you know, it certainly wasn't called a film noir when it was released, but it was a hugely popular movie when it was made because Rita Hayworth was just the biggest star in Hollywood at that moment in time. Conversely, a film like In a Lonely Place was overlooked when it was released in 1950, and only now it has established this reputation as one of the great films of its time. So when we program this, we want to show things that are like touchstones for people who maybe are experiencing it for the first time, maybe have seen the film but haven't seen it on a big screen, which is always great, and then combine them with films that are considered somewhat rarities, like Night Has a Thousand Eyes, and certainly Never Open That Door, which is a Spanish language film from Argentina that my foundation just restored this year. But it's based on stories by Cornell Woolrich, who was arguably the most prolific writer of noir fiction in America in this era. And his fame was such that, you know, this Argentinian director came to the United States specifically to get the rights to these three stories that comprise the film, and did a magnificent job directing it. It's as good as any adaptation of Woolrich made anywhere at any time. You kind of have to combine the well-known stuff, realizing that not everybody has seen it, you know, and then pair that with some real rarities that you're only going to see at our festival.
Now, you mentioned that the Film Noir Foundation is preserving and restoring films. You're dealing with films that are almost a century old in many cases, and they weren't always valued at the time. So
or now.
So this must be, in some cases, a real challenge for you.
Yeah, it's just very interesting that, you know, it's only been recently that people have learned about the life expectancy of film. And now they have to learn about the life expectancy of digital, because people think that digital is everything, but it's not an archival medium, really, at least not yet. And anybody knows that who, you know, they bought VHS tapes or they bought CDs or something, and then everything switches to Blu-ray, and it's like, well, you better have saved your DVD player if you want to watch those things. And don't get me started on streaming, because streaming is so dangerous, because somebody owns that stream. Somebody has the power to turn the spigot on and off, and it's not us. So if that's how you're getting your movies, I mean, just realize that at some point they can just say, yeah, we're not showing that anymore. And it's gone. It's gone. You know, so when we restore and preserve films, we preserve them photochemically, by and large, and we keep them in a collection that's the Film Noir Foundation collection at the UCLA Film and Television Archive. So they will, when we preserve them, they will always be there, and they will always be available for screenings and stuff like that. But it's very tricky with streaming.
Yeah, hold on to your physical media.
Good advice.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Counsor. And today we're talking about film history. Our guest right now is Eddie Muller. He's an author, a film preservationist, founder of the Film Noir Foundation, and the host of Noir Alley on the Turner Classic Movies channel. And he's coming to Portland for the upcoming Noir City Film Festival. Well, I do want to circle back to something you said earlier. You're talking about neo-noir films, the Coen brothers with Blood Simple. That kind of kicked off this trend in the 1980s and 90s of a new generation of filmmakers who built on the noir genre. There was John Dahl with Red Rock West, Tarantino with Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, David Lynch with Blue Velvet.
Yep. Chris Nolan, of course, started out making a kind of noir. His first film following in black and white that he made in England was definitely a film noir. They're just all kinds of filmmakers, you know, the ones who've gone on to be famous. I mean, I was impressed that you pulled John Dahl out there, because, I mean, he really had a feel for this, you know, The Last Seduction and Red Rock West. And he's done a lot of really good work. But you know, I just saw my buddy Carl Franklin the other day, the writer-director, you know, and he did One False Move, which is a fantastic film that I love, and Devil in a Blue Dress with Denzel Washington, which is like a classic, you know, detective story, but with a black detective. So, yeah, a lot of filmmakers get into this early in their careers, you know. You can really see the influence that noir had on them. Either from the movies or from the books, because the Coen brothers are extremely well read. They know their Pulp Fiction inside and out, you know, and it continues to this day that people are like, I have to tell you, I get emails all the time from people saying, if you have a chance and want to look at my first film that I made, it's a homage to film noir. And yeah.
Yep, I think every film student, that's kind of their first, because like you said, they're cheap to make.
Exactly, exactly. And they're very dynamic, you know, I mean, everybody kind of gets it. You get the visual approach to these stories that the filmmakers have, and it's just so stylized. It's always funny when people describe film noir as realistic, and I say, in what world do you think these films are realistic? They may be dealing with, you know, really intense human emotions and stuff, but the approach is not realistic at all. It's super stylized. The acting, the dialogue, the cinematography, you know, these are not realistic movies at all.
So are there hidden layers to some of the older noir films that modern audiences may not appreciate? Social, political themes?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, and it's so one of the things that makes it so interesting to me, and especially when I present films for younger audiences today, is they don't realize that there was a production code in effect, and that there were things you could and could not do on the screen. And it becomes as a revelation to younger people to realize it wasn't just that acting was corny. It wasn't just that, you know, Hollywood movies weren't that realistic. It was like there was an establishment that was forcing the films to be that way. And so the filmmakers had to be very, very creative to work around the code. So you could tell stories that were very adult and had dealt with some ideas. Like Gilda, for example, that we're showing is a film that when I, 25 years ago, when I first started doing this and I showed that movie and I said, you know, this is probably the most perverse movie made in Hollywood ever up to that point because of the sexual dynamics of the film. And a lot of people were like, you're crazy. That didn't happen. And I just wanted to say, seriously, you didn't think there were bisexual people in the 1940s? You didn't think that this stuff existed? It's just that they weren't showing it on movie screens. You had to find a creative way to do it. And so it was very interesting when I was researching that book I mentioned, Dark City Dames, I became very good friends with Evelyn Keyes, who was one of the actresses I profiled. And she had been married to Charles Vidor, who directed Gilda. And when I said, you know, I've always thought this was happening and that this was, and she was like, oh my God, of course, you know, Charles snuck so much stuff into these movies. And we watched the movie together and she confirmed like, this means this. And it's all symbolic, but it's all there. It's all intended to be there. You know, I remember showing The Big Combo one time in Hollywood, and I had Earl Holliman as a guest at the screening. And Earl Holliman, I don't know if you've seen that movie, but he and Lee Van Cleef play hitmen in that film. And clearly these guys are gay in the movie, right? And there was dialogue that was just outrageous to get this across, but no one in the censor's office called it out because it was so subtle in a way that saying you got it like was revealing something about you that they didn't want to say. So they just got all this stuff in the movie, and Earl Holliman was like, you got that? You actually feel? And I said, oh man, it's so obvious. He goes, yeah, well, we thought we were really pulling one over on these people, you know. And anyway, so it's very, to me, all that stuff is very, very amusing, you know.
We mentioned that you're an author. Your books include The Distance, a crime novel, Dark City, The Lost World of Film Noir, and an authorized biography, Tab Hunter Confidential, The Making of a Movie Star.
Yep, all of those. I did write all of those, yes.
Well, I'm wondering, because Tab Hunter was a mid-century heartthrob and sort of the furthest thing from a film noir figure. What made you team up with Tab on this book?
We'll go right back to Evelyn Keyes again. I mean, that's how important Evelyn was in my life. Is she was friends with Tab, and Tab was trying to get just a book together to sell, and, you know, a memoir of his life. And he had worked with a few writers previously that he did not get along with. And Evelyn mentioned me to him because we had known each other for a year or so. And Tab read my profile, if you will, of Evelyn in the book and said, wow, this is her. I mean, he really captured her. And so we met and talked about it, and I agreed to do it. It was great. I mean, let's face it. I had written several books before that, you know, are film books, and I was not on TCM or anything. So, you know, there's no real money involved in any of that stuff. But then writing Tab Hunter's autobiography actually had money involved in it. And Tab was a phenomenal collaborator. He was great. I mean, we were co-authors of that book. I did not necessarily ghostwrite it. And I was really grateful that he was as generous as he was in presenting me as the co-author. Instead, you know, a lot of people who do an autobiography, they kind of hide the collaborator, they hide the writer. Tab didn't do that. I mean, he brought me along on tour with him on occasion, and we had a really good relationship.
Well, you're bringing some really notable examples of film noir to the Hollywood Theater in Portland. They're all going to be shown on the big screen, the way the original filmmakers intended.
I love the sound of that.
So starting on July 19th, there's Gilda, there's The Window, there's No Abras Nunca Esa Puerta, also known as Never Open That Door, The Night Has a Thousand Eyes, The Man Who Cheated Himself, and In a Lonely Place. And it all goes through July 21st.
Starting on the 19th, going to the 21st. And Night Has a Thousand Eyes is also a Cornell Woolrich. So almost, I think, half the movies we're showing are based on Cornell Woolrich stories, because The Window is also a Cornell Woolrich story. Night Has a Thousand Eyes and No Abras Nunca Esa Puerta, Never Open That Door. Those are all Woolrich movies. So, right, that's half of them. They're all really great.
And the Noir City Film Festival will be featuring not just films, but other events. You'll be hosting a conversation on July 20th.
Yeah, that's fun. The guy who really is responsible for getting me up there and is like shepherding this whole thing is Ted Herleman, who is on the board of the Hollywood Theater. And Ted will be in conversation with me. It's Saturday afternoon, I think. And I really enjoy doing that, because it gives me an opportunity to speak a little differently than just introducing the movies. You know, I have a thing that I do when I introduce these movies, but to be in conversation, I really enjoy having the opportunity to speak a little more off the cuff and informally.
Well, you're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we've been talking today with Eddie Muller. He's an author, film preservationist, founder of the Film Noir Foundation, and the host of Noir Alley on the Turner Classic Movies channel. Eddie, it's been great fun. Thanks for joining us.
It has been an absolute pleasure. I thank you so much for inviting me to do this, and I want to sign your guest book when I'm in Portland.
I look forward to that. How can our listeners find out more about your work and about the Noir City Film Festival at the Hollywood Theater?
Well, I apologize for the long URL, but if you go to filmnoirfoundation.org, that will tell you everything you want to know about the foundation, and it links to our noircity.com website, which lists all of the festivals that we do around the country. Portland is now part of, or is once again, part of a network of festivals we do around the country, because we also are in Hollywood and in the San Francisco Bay Area and Seattle, Chicago, Detroit, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. So that's how people can find out about those things. And then there's eddiemuller.com. That's my personal website, which really needs to be updated pretty soon.
People can also go to the Hollywood Theater's website. That's hollywoodtheater.org.
Fantastic.
We'll be right back with Elliot Levine. And now we're joined by filmmaker, programmer, and instructor Elliot Levine. He's here to tell us all about a film series that's playing at Portland's Cinema 21. Elliot, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Conch. Great to be here.
Okay, tell us all about your Saturday Morning Classics series.
Well, as many people are finding out, at Cinema 21, we've been playing classic films going back to the 30s all the way through the 90s. We have regular 4 and 5 week series that are sort of thematically grouped together. This month, we're doing 5 from the 70s. Next month, we're going to do a month of Westerns. So it kind of follows that thematic trail. And the shows are great. We are showing gorgeous, gorgeous prints on the big, big Cinema 21 screen in the big room. And it's been an amazing experience doing this series. It caught on from the very beginning. It seemed like this was something in that particular neighborhood that was very welcome. And it's reaching out. People from all over Portland are now showing up every Saturday morning. Even you. I've seen you there.
That's right. And Cinema 21, they still have the 35mm projection equipment in their main theater.
In the main room, they do. That theater is awesome. I'll be the first to say it. It's just a beautiful, beautiful place to watch movies. Yeah.
So this month is 1970s films, and a number of these came along at the tail end of the New Hollywood movement. Yeah, that was when American films started to catch up with the auteur movement that had been sweeping European cinema.
Totally true on all counts. Late 60s into the entire decade of the 70s actually was prime territory for the New Hollywood. That's when, you know, censorship restrictions, things like that, the things that were once taboo in movies for, gosh, since the mid-30s, the Hays Code put an end to lascivious entertainment in 1934. And things really didn't change until the late 60s with films like Bonnie and Clyde, Wild Bunch. But by the 70s, things were so amped up that you could almost get away with anything short of actual on-screen sex or, you know, actual murder. But the realism that was being now expressed in films was phenomenal. And, you know, you can argue, you know, back and forth that some will say that those censorial restrictions really brought out a stronger sense of creativity, that you had to really rely on cinematic trickery and skill in order to pull things off. And not that these are all that provocative. I mean, in this particular group, there aren't any films that really push the limits in terms of content and violence and sex. They're just more interesting. They're more grown-up pictures. The actors talk like real people talk. The situations seem real. Like in Last Picture Show, there's a lot of frank depictions of sexual relations, human relationships that you don't really see in older films so much, simply because you couldn't. When films like French Connection and Last Picture Show started getting Oscars, it was an open invitation to join the party and, you know, try to make as many provocative films as you could.
Well, your lineup of Westerns is an interesting mix. Rio Bravo is a star-studded family-friendly affair from Howard Hawks. The Wild Bunch, on the other hand, that's Sam Peckinpah's radical revisionist Western. It inflamed a lot of film critics and audiences back in 1969.
It sure did, but it also, at the same time, kicked down the door of what was possible in a film. And Westerns are a hard sell anyway. And the idea that Peckinpah would invest this much time and energy and expense into a film that could have been a major folly, it could have just been a disaster financially. He took the chances that other directors were too timid to take. And he said, no, let's just do it. Let's make a movie in an authentic way that shows the way things are, the way people die. They don't just fall off a horse when they're shot. Body parts go flying. And yeah, a lot of people don't like that. They don't feel there's a need for that. But other people do. I do.
All right. You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And we've been talking today with film programmers Eddie Muller and Elliot Levine. Elliot, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure, and I'll talk to you soon. I hope to see you at Cinema 21.
Yeah, for those listeners who'd like to find out more about your Saturday Morning Classics film series, where would they look?
Well, they should go immediately to cinema21.com, and when you get to their website, scroll over to Saturday Morning Classics. It'll give you the whole rundown.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.